CBS Special, See It Now Studios, in the Oval Office.
Mr. Colson, Mr. President.
Yeah.
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
I've really got to tend to the business of the country, you know. I'm trying to keep people from keeping me out of the goddamn thing, you know, because I know nothing about it.
I think you should keep out of it, Mr. President. The biggest negative to the Watergate, in my mind, eventually, it's going to come out. There's just too damn many people involved.
Oh, sure. The whole goddamn story's going to come out.
A headline, The Watergate Caper.
Explain something to me, will you, Mr. Ehrlichman? Breaking and entering. Wiretapping. Five burglars, business suits, $100 bills in their pockets.
Caught in the act of burglarizing and bugging Democratic headquarters in Washington.
I had no prior knowledge of the Watergate break-in.
But the episode grew steadily more sinister.
Conspiracy to commit kidnapping. Destruction of government documents.
I remember well his instructions. He told me to shred the documents and deep six the briefcase.
It was, in many ways, a cesspool.
Secret slush funds, laundering money in Mexico, payoffs to silence witnesses.
President Nixon, you could get $1 million and you could get it in cash. I know where it could be gotten.
Nixon was dark and paranoid. He tried to use the FBI, he tried to use the CIA.
It is a level of unimaginable corruption.
It was intended to undermine the very basis of American democracy, free and unfettered elections.
Spying by undercover agents, plans to firebomb a building, conspiracy to obstruct justice.
It's a cautionary tale, and I think it's one of the reasons you're still talking about it 50 years later.
All of this by the Law and Order administration of Richard Nixon.
A clean-shaven man sweats profusely.
Is there a question in there somewhere?
He smiles. Overlapping letters coalesce to form an image of Richard Nixon smiling and making V's with his fingers. Photos show money, a tape recorder, Nixon, and mugshots. Black, red, white, and blue stripes move across an image of Nixon. Photos map onto his profile. A title, Watergate, High Crimes in the White House, with Nixon.
America's in trouble today not because her people have failed, but because her leaders have failed. And what America needs our leaders to match the greatness of her people.
People in a crowd hold signs that read, Nixon. A large sign reads, Nixon's the one. He makes V's for victory and waves at the crowd. In an interview with a white-haired woman.
Every couple of generations, we get a moment of scandal.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Loss of confidence in our leadership, loss of confidence in our system.
The photo shows Bill Clinton.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
This is the first time an elected president of the United States has been impeached by the House.
The person at the top infects everything below.
Over the past several weeks, we've amassed overwhelming evidence about a fake election.
Photos show the Capitol riot.
We've seen it. We've seen it recently. And we lived through it during Watergate.
Text appears over grainy footage of the United States Capitol, 1972. In an interview with Leslie Stahl, CBS News correspondent.
I came along in April of 1972.
The photo shows her as a young woman.
Brand new. I had just started.
Tomorrow, United States pilots will ask the International Pilots Association to join them in a worldwide boycott of countries that harbor hijackers. Leslie Stahl, CBS News, Washington.
The Washington Bureau of CBS was huge, but it was also the middle of the 1972 presidential campaign.
Archival footage shows glimpses from presidential campaign rallies.
So most of the reporters were out covering candidates.
It is the consensus of Republican opinion here that Richard Nixon is the one who will win the New Hampshire primary. The question is, by how much?
Pleasure to introduce the next president of the United States.
Nixon's opponent smiles at a crowd. Signs in the crowd read, McGovern. Nighttime, a distant view shows the Washington Monument. In Leslie's interview,
it's June 17th, 1972. There's a crackle of noise on the police radios that there's a break-in at the Watergate. at the Democratic Party headquarters.
A retro TV airs a news broadcast.
Good evening. We have a mystery story out of Washington. Five people have been arrested and charged with breaking into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee in the middle of the night.
Very few news organizations thought it registered as a story at all. But CBS had a sort of scent about this.
People work in a newsroom. A man holds a phone to his ear. Someone presses buttons on a control board.
The assignment editor sees there's a break-in at the National Democratic Committee. He looks around the newsroom, and there's no one. So he sends a new kid.
Police arrested five men in the Watergate with bugging equipment and copying cameras.
A U.S. Marshal van pulls into a parking lot.
Arrested at gunpoint, the men refused to give their names or to say why they'd broken in. The five men also had on them 11 crisp new $100 bills, all with consecutive serial numbers, as though someone had gone to the bank and cashed a large check, all in $100 bills.
Men enter a building.
I was called in about 8 o'clock that morning. The arrest had already been made.
Angelo J. Lano, FBI special agent.
I would say that it was not the best organized burglary. The question was, who are these individuals?
Handcuffed men step out of the U.S. Marshal van. Close views show five men's mugshots.
So my partner and I went to the lockup and attempted to interview the arrestees. And they refused to say anything.
With Leslie.
They sent me to the arraignment. As the testimony went forward, you became more and more suspicious. There were $100 bills with consecutive numbers. These guys were Cubans. You kept sitting up thinking, my, this is not just a third-rate burglary.
Glimpses show police documents and evidence photos.
There were only two other reporters there. I turned to the guy from the Washington Post next to me, and I kept saying, am I hearing this right? And he said, you are. My name's Bob Woodward.
A photo shows Bob.
I was asleep. And I got a call from the Washington Post on this wonderful, beautiful Saturday morning, June 17th, 1972, said there'd been a burglary at the Democratic headquarters. Could I come in?
In an interview with Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post.
I saw all this commotion out at the city desk and heard about this break-in at the Democratic headquarters. I said, this is a better story than the one I'm working on. And so I said to the city editor, what if I just make a few phone calls?
A photo shows devices labeled FBI. Archival footage shows Larry O'Brien, Democratic National Chairman.
There were taps on at least two telephones. Becomes clearer by the day that a most serious crime has been committed.
Inside the Watergate Hotel.
This file cabinet was found with the lock picked, the bar that holds the cabinet in place lying on the floor, a drawer open.
They wanted to know what was in the files. They wanted to find out everything they could about the campaign.
They'd gone in May, the month before, to plant eavesdropping devices.
Footage shows Nixon looking pensive.
It was a basic Nixon operation. Get dirt on the other side that can be used as leverage.
Mike Wallace.
One of the men apprehended yesterday while allegedly attempting to bug the offices of the Democratic National Committee in Washington has been identified as the security coordinator for the principal Republican committee to re-elect President Nixon.
When the arraignment judge asked James McCord, where did you work? McCord went, and the judge kept saying, speak up. Finally, McCord said, CIA. And I think I blurted out, holy s***.
Photos show the five accused men.
The first arrests were dismissed by the White House as a minor incident. The Watergate affair began to look less minor when, along with the five, two other men were indicted who had escaped immediate arrest. G. Gordon Liddy, finance counsel to the Nixon Campaign Organization. Ex-FBI, ex-Treasury, ex-White House consultant. And E. Howard Hunt, Jr., ex-CIA, ex-Bay of Pigs planner, ex-White House consultant.
Archival footage shows Bob and Carl in the Washington Post newsroom.
There was this entry in the address books of the Watergate burglars. H. Hunt, Dash W House. So I called the White House and asked for H. Hunt, who turned out to be Howard Hunt. I said, how is it that your name and phone number is in the address books of two of the burglars caught at the Watergate? And Hunt screamed out, good God, hung up the phone and left town.
One day after the break-in, glimpses show the Watergate Hotel.
The big flap over the weekend has been the news. A group of five people have been caught breaking into the Democratic headquarters. The real problem here is whether anything is traceable to Gordon Liddy.
President Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, kept a private audio diary.
Haldeman was the gatekeeper, frequently criticized for isolating the president. He once said, every president needs an SOB, and I'm Nixon's.
These recordings have rarely been heard. Voice of H.R. Haldeman.
The president was concerned about what our counterattack is, our PR offensive to top this. We've got to hope that the FBI doesn't go beyond the necessary in developing evidence and that we can keep a lid on that.
Grainy footage shows Haldeman writing in a notebook. With Angelo.
People were being called, questioned by the FBI. We did the job that we were asked to do and let the chips fall where they may. And if it led to the White House, let it fall.
I have no comment to make.
As we go through the various moments in this story.
Who posted your bond, Mr. McCord?
McCord turns away.
You get the sense of one revelation after the next that's explosive. Each one was a peeling away at Nixon. It was as if he was covered in Band-Aids and we were just ripping them off one after the next.
With Bob and Carl.
Watergate was not about the burglars.
That's right.
Watergate was about a whole campaign of sabotage and espionage, about cover-up, about a war against the press, a war against the system of justice.
That was a subversion of our democracy.
People have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
He said he wasn't a crook, but that was the point. He was a crook.
The central mysteries still remain. What were those men after at the Watergate? Who sent them? How were they paid? What's making the Republicans nervous is it's beginning to look as though some members of the president's re-election committee may know the answers.
In a retro living room, a television shows an interview with Nixon. Watergate high crimes in the White House.
Some public men are destined to be loved, and other public men are destined to be disliked. But the most important thing about a public man is not whether he's loved or disliked, but whether he's respected. And I hope to restore respect to the presidency.
Grainy footage shows Nixon waving to a crowd as he walks. Balloons and confetti fall on the crowd from above. 1968. Dwight Chapin, deputy assistant to the president.
When he was running for president in the 1968 period, the nation really was undergoing all kinds of stress and strain.
In archival footage, buildings burn and young adults fight with police.
We had that year the assassination of Martin Luther King. We had the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. We had fires in the major cities, riots.
Footage shows police officers beating and dragging citizens.
I mean, it was just utter turmoil.
Let's make America first again in respect for order and justice under law. Now, isn't that what you want? Isn't that where we're going to go?
I was the president's appointment secretary.
The photo shows Chapin as a young man.
I believe I knew him very well. I've heard that term of it, that Nixon was an introvert in an extrovert's job, and I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Nixon stands outside. Facing a crowd, he shakes hands and waves. Photos show him making the victory symbol.
As far as the charisma and all the PR tricks and everything else that's supposed to make you look like a matinee idol, forget it. If that's what they want in a president, I'm not the man.
A wall-sized photo shows a man standing on a circular stage.
You know, we're all complicated. None of us are one thing. We're filled with contradictions. And so's Nixon.
With Leslie.
He pushed for and got passed things that we call liberal today.
Yeah, there'll be no pollution in that land.
In the environmental movement.
Clean air, clean water, open spaces. These should once again be the birthright of every American.
They were just opening up relations with China. Nixon and Kissinger were just beginning to have a little detente with China for the first time, and detente with Russia, the Soviet Union. There was a sense of a man of depth and a sense that he really did want to make positive change in the world.
Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made from the White House.
Light shines on the rug in the Oval Office. Nixon sits at the desk and makes a phone call.
And then there's this, I guess you would call it, corrupt side to him.
Haldeman, they're all out of jail. They've all been taken care of. President Nixon. All out on bail. Well, they took a hell of a risk, and they have to be paid. That's all there is to that.
There was a racist streak. He was anti-Semitic.
The Jews are born spies. They're just in it, up to their necks.
So he's confusing. You can't just say, what's Nixon like? There are too many contradictions to have an easy answer.
Nixon grips his telephone. Glimpses show soldiers in Vietnam.
One of the dominant things going on in 1972, and it predated Nixon's election, was the anti-war movement in this country.
With each escalation, the world comes closer to the brink of cosmic disaster.
And the war, and the free, Vietnam, the Vietnamese, and
the momentum of the anti-war movement is building. The sense that the military is not telling us the truth has come to the fore because of the leak of the Pentagon Papers.
The newspaper had printed excerpts from thousands of classified Pentagon papers detailing the hidden history of the Vietnam War.
Nixon, in absolute frustration, and somewhat justifiable, in my opinion, was pounding the desk in the Oval Office saying, we've got to do something to stop these expletive deleted leaks. I want those classified documents protected.
And that's where the plumbers began.
That's where the plumbers started.
The hiring of Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt, they were called the plumbers in the White House, to plug leaks.
A newspaper headline, Liddy and Hunt reportedly fled during bugging raid.
The shadow of corruption cast by the Watergate bugging caper keeps growing larger and more menacing instead of disappearing, as the Republicans had hoped.
The first 12 weeks of the story established all the critical lines, and especially the discovery of a secret fund that paid for the undercover activities of the Nixon campaign.
Secret money found on the men who broke into Democratic headquarters.
The secret fund had $700,000 in cash. Astonishing in itself.
Glimpses show bank documents.
We had this list of all of the employees of the Committee for the Re-election of the President.
In a living room, a woman stares out a window.
And one of them was the bookkeeper named Judy Hoback.
Nighttime, grainy footage outside a house moves toward a window.
On the night of September 14th, there was a knock on the door. It was Carl Bernstein.
Judy Hoback, bookkeeper, committee to re-elect the president.
She was scared. That was the first thing that came through.
I immediately knew that I had an awful lot of information.
Archival footage shows someone counting money.
Our main job was to account for the funds that came in through donations. People would come with brown paper bags of cash, more cash than I ever dreamed of seeing in my lifetime.
In an interview with Bob and Carl,
it became apparent that she was not a blind loyalist to Richard Nixon, and that something had occurred that made her think that things were not as they should be. And she kind of blurted out that Hugh Sloan, the treasurer, had quit because he was disturbed by what he had seen.
I learned about the break-in by reading the newspaper like everybody else.
A headline, five held in plot to bug Democrats' office here.
Hugh Sloan was a senior member of the Nixon campaign and was the treasurer.
When CREEP, the Committee to Re-elect the President, was being established, Hugh moved out of my operation at the West Wing and went over to CREEP. Hugh is a man of great integrity.
Archival glimpses show Hugh as a young man and the Washington Monument.
Gordon Liddy came into the office. He was obviously in a hurry.
With Hugh.
In passing me in the hall, told me my boys got caught last night. I made a mistake. I'm going to lose my job.
Hugh Sloan, treasurer.
Knowing I'd just given a whole lot of cash to Gordon Liddy, I was making the assumption that probably I unwittingly had paid for this.
The White House denied and continues to deny involvement in any wrongdoing. Immediately after the break-in, the Committee to Re-elect the President fired McCord. When Liddy refused to answer FBI questions, he was fired too.
Watergate conspirator Gordon Liddy received $235,000 on the say-so of Haldeman's man in the committee, Jeb Magruder.
I was summoned by Jeb Magruder, who said, we have a problem about the Liddy money. We need to agree on a number. We need a lower number. I said, Jeb, I'm not going to perjure myself over this thing. And he rather chillingly said, well, you may have to.
With Chapin.
Hugh came up to me and he started describing what was going on over at CREEP. He says, there's too much money. Things are out of control. Something bad is going to happen.
In my mind, what was developing clearly was a cover-up.
I'd like my attorney to answer the question.
I staked out in my own mind how I was going to deal with this. And fortunately, I was supported by my wife, who was a rock through all this for me.
Deborah Sloan.
I worked in the East Wing of the White House as assistant to the social secretary.
Hugh sits with his arm around Deborah. A photo shows her as a young woman.
We had really led a fairy tale existence.
A photo shows the Sloans as a young couple.
And then suddenly, this happened.
In the following weeks, two top-level operatives left the Nixon campaign. John Mitchell, former attorney general, cited family reasons for his departure as campaign manager. Hugh Sloan Jr. resigned as campaign treasurer because he said his wife was expecting a child shortly.
When we talked about his resigning, I was very upset, and I was afraid I was going to go into labor prematurely. But we both knew that we didn't believe in lying for anybody. I would not have married him if he was didn't have the integrity that he did have.
A photo shows the Sloan standing outside a house.
Can you confirm the report that in your...
When Hugh Sloan decided to resign, he said, you need to stay there so you can tell the truth when it's needed to be told.
I do not wish to make any further comment.
There were many people knocking on our door. But Woodward and Bernstein were the most persistent.
Hugh Sloan had a conscience. He was snagged in, and he didn't like it, and he wanted to help us.
I was very upset that Hugh Sloan was being sort of pinned as the fall guy, and I really, at this point, wanted the truth to come out.
A blurred view shows the desk in the Oval Office.
I felt very strongly that it probably went way to the top.
I had no prior knowledge of the Watergate break-in. I neither took part in nor knew about any of the subsequent cover-up activities. I neither authorized nor encouraged subordinates to engage in illegal or improper campaign tactics. That was, and that is, the simple truth.
Watergate, high crimes in the White House. At a campaign rally, a crowd holds red, white, and blue balloons. People hold signs and wave American flags. August 1972. Nixon smiles and waves to the crowd.
Tonight, I again proudly accept that nomination for President of the United States.
With Leslie Stahl, CBS News correspondent.
At the end of 1972, as we were getting closer to the election, Walter Cronkite, our leader at CBS News, decided that this story is very confusing. He believed it was a huge story that reached right up to the highest levels of power. And he set out to explain the complications.
October 27, 1972.
At first, it was called the Watergate Caper. Five men, apparently caught in the act of burglarizing and bugging Democratic headquarters in Washington. But the episode grew steadily more sinister.
Walter Cronkite was an icon. He did not appear partisan. He gave you the facts. You believed him. You trusted him. You trusted that he would be telling you the truth.
We shall try tonight to pull together the threads of this amazing story, quite unlike any in our modern American history.
It was clear there were links reaching into the White House.
And for secret intelligence work and dirty tricks against the Democrats.
Tried to recruit at least 12 attorneys for political espionage.
Of a bookkeeping nightmare in a massive effort to conceal
campaign. They keep issuing general denials. They are depending upon that and silence to make the allegations go away.
Charges of a high-level campaign of political sabotage and espionage, apparently unparalleled in American history.
Bob and Carl look at a tablet.
Wow.
Yeah. This was a dreary time. The Post was a local newspaper then. There was no internet. There was no circulation in the United States. CBS had taken the Post national.
On the Dick Cavett Show.
The initial phase, the television coverage was pretty poor. CBS, in the last 2 weeks of the campaign, I think, did a great service by airing the issue on two long segments on the Cronkite Show.
And very courageously, in fact.
Right, under pressure from the White House not to go with it.
The story was losing impetus. And yet, with the body of evidence that they had brought together, it was a whale of a story, of course.
Glimpses show newspaper headlines.
Who got the wiretap reports? How was the information used? What is this last unanswered question, which points the way from the Watergate caper to the Watergate affair? Charges that Watergate was only part of, in the Washington Post words, a broad campaign of political espionage and sabotage against the Democratic Party.
He tells the public that, in effect, a crime has been committed, and it reaches pretty high up in the government. Just the fact that Walter did this himself. He didn't lead to another reporter. He did the report. Had a huge impact.
Light shines into the Oval Office. President Nixon. You see CBS on the Watergate business? Very damaging politically. H.R. Haldeman audio diary.
The president had a strong reaction to CBS's special report on the Watergate last night. Says, quote, that finishes them, close quote, and he's ready to write CBS off completely.
There was blood in the water. We had done a lot to create hostility with the press. I mean, we were greatly responsible for that. There was a real hostility, adversary relationship.
Between the Nixon White House and the press generally.
The press generally.
Print and television.
Print and television.
I have never heard or seen such outrageous, vicious, distorted reporting in 27 years of public life.
Nixon literally said, the most powerful institution in the country is not the presidency, not the Supreme Court, not the Congress, but the press. And they are vicious and they are after you.
Mr. President, what is it about the television coverage of you in these past weeks and months that has so aroused your anger?
Nixon shakes his head.
Don't get the impression that you arouse my anger.
Nixon grins.
You see, one can only be angry with those he respects.
Dan Rather, CBS News correspondent.
If any or all of what is alleged to have been going on is true, how high up in the White House does it go? There are three key names: Mitchell, Haldeman, and Chapin.
To those of us on the Nixon side, it's viewed as a political event. It's October. We're coming into a November election. We're getting this disproportionate coverage that portrays us as
criminal-like, and we're rebelling against it.
It did make the public aware of how high up this story went into the White House, but it didn't change public opinion that much. You know, Nixon was pretty popular.
Reporting from CBS News election headquarters in New York, here is correspondent Walter Cronkite.
Good evening again. Some or all of the polls have closed now in some 31 of the states, and President Nixon is well on the way toward the predicted landslide re-election.
Nixon won a massive landslide re-election, but it was a sense of dread in the Nixon White House that we have been caught. The Grand Inquisition is beginning.
H.R. Haldeman audio diary.
General agreement on the strategy that we should keep the outward appearance of total cooperation, but our objective internally should be maximum obstruction and containment.
Nixon enters the briefing room.
Real progress has been made in finding the truth. I condemn any attempts to cover up in this case, no matter who is involved.
Footage shows a young Chapin.
That gets to the problem of what we do with Chapin, which concerns the president greatly. He's very determined that we not do anything that's harmful in any way to Dwight especially, but feels that we can't keep him in the White House.
After the election, there was a senator by the name of Sam Ervin, and he was getting ready to hold some hearings. It was felt that if I left and if Chuck Colson left, that might head off the hearings. And therefore, I was going to have to leave the White House.
Cronkite reports.
The White House confirmed today that Dwight Chapin is leaving this spring from his job as President Nixon's appointment secretary. The spokesman, however, denied reports that Chapin's being forced out because of stories linking him to the political espionage against the Democrats.
It was incredibly painful. I use the term heartbroken, but I also had been around the track. They felt that if they started cleaning house, that they could maybe avoid the Sam Ervin hearings thing.
The acknowledged leader of the Senate's forces in this long war is Sam Ervin of North Carolina.
Ervin has promised that there will be revelations of new material, events not yet reported in the press, and he says some of them are going to be startling.
May 17, 1973.
11 months to the day from the Watergate break-in, Chairman Sam Ervin launched his bipartisan Senate committee on a months-long series of hearings trying to find out who, how, and why.
And then all of a sudden this comes onto television, live, every day.
The long silence maintained by the Watergate insiders appears to be breaking down.
And we had the reporters at these long tables, and famous people came, movie stars, people from abroad came to sit in that room.
I'm on holiday for 3 weeks, and I'm here to hear the Watergate hearings.
Everybody watched, the whole country.
If the many allegations made to this date are true, then the burglars who broke into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee at the Watergate were in effect breaking into the home of every citizen of the United States.
Men swear in to the hearings. James McCord, John Ehrlichman, Hugh Sloan, E. Howard Hunt, Donald Segretti.
Shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
The hearing itself, from the very beginning, established a kind of momentum.
After your arrest, did you receive any money?
Yes, I did.
He asked me where the paper shredder was.
That we had to come up with a very good story to justify why.
And then you got to Dean.
Your name is John W. Dean III.
That is correct.
You may be seated.
Here he is, a man who was Richard Nixon's chief counsel. He walked you through scenes in the Oval Office with the president, each scene implicating Richard Nixon. He just took the curtain and opened it up, and the man standing there was Richard Nixon. It was the turning point in Watergate.
A close view shows Dean's face. Watergate, high crimes in the White House. Reporters surround Dean.
The man in the middle in the Watergate scandal, accuser and accused, is 34-year-old John Wesley Dean III. Fired as counselor to President Nixon after issuing a statement that he would not be a scapegoat He went to federal prosecutors bargaining for immunity if he would tell all.
I think that a lot of people just don't really accept the truth for what it really is. And I think that I felt I could be some sort of catalyst to start getting the truth out.
John Dean was in charge of anything involving political intelligence. So when the Watergate break-in happened, John Dean knew precisely what had transpired.
Did you read the article about Mr. Colson and the charges that you were an early and willing participant in the Watergate cover-up?
I haven't read the paper yet. I'm sorry.
My job was to stake people out before they testified. I was sent out to John Dean's house, and I thought, oh, this is fantastic. I'm going to get a big, huge story. And all he told me was that he got a haircut.
I have no comment. Sorry.
Dean drives into his garage. A distorted view shows footage of Dean.
Nixon had put Dean supposedly in charge of investigating what had happened, when in fact Dean became integral to the cover-up itself.
At the hearing.
Stand up and raise your right hand. Do you swear that the evidence...
He testified for days.
The Watergate matter was an inevitable outgrowth. I learned that any means, legal or illegal, to get some thugs to remove the demand.
And he basically said Nixon was deeply involved in the cover-up.
I left the meeting with the impression that the president was well aware of what had been going on regarding the success of keeping the White House out of the Watergate scandal. And I had also expressed to him my concern that I was not confident that the cover-up could be maintained indefinitely.
Here he is, a man from within the White House, within the Oval Office, now turns the tables, spills the beans.
The power of Dean's testimony was he implicated himself. He didn't say, I didn't do this. He said, I did it.
I subsequently met with Mr. Ehrlichman to inform him of the contents of Hunt's safe. I remember well his instructions. He told me to shred the documents and deep six the briefcase.
Dean was the perfect witness. He had all these details. There was no way for him not to be credible to any open-minded person.
With Sam Dash.
I always was somewhat squeamish about, you know, how much I believe we could believe John Dean.
Did you just have an impression as to his knowledge of the cover-up, or did you have a conviction concerning that?
And I tried to cross-examine him. I couldn't break him. But nevertheless, maybe he was a really fluent liar.
Richard Benveniste, Chief Prosecutor, Watergate Task Force.
I was skeptical about John Dean's implication of Richard Nixon. It seemed to me this young guy, who was only a few years older than I was at the time, was perhaps exaggerating.
What's your opinion of John Dean?
I think, in all fairness to the man, you'd have to put him right up there with Judas Iscariot. He being a betrayer of a person in a high position.
With Liddy.
And what do you think his motive was?
Save his ass.
At the hearing.
I'm quite aware of the fact that in some circumstances, it's going to be my word against one man's word. It's going to be my word against two men. It's going to be my word against three men. And probably in some cases, it's going to be my word against four men. I know the truth is my ally in this, and I think ultimately the truth is going to come out.
Glimpses show buildings and monuments around Washington, D.C. 3 weeks later, grainy glimpses show footage from the hearing.
Good evening. There was a startling development in the Senate Watergate hearings today.
Committee attention seemed focused elsewhere, members whispering to each other, at one point huddling outside. And word spread of a mystery witness.
This was a secret witness. He appeared out of nowhere. We didn't know who he was. Who is he?
Suppose just for the record that you state your name and present occupation and address.
A middle-aged man testifies.
My name is Alexander Porter Butterfield.
With Butterfield.
I was called deputy assistant to the president. That put me in charge of the president's official day.
A black and white photo shows him as a younger man.
I became increasingly close to him throughout that four-year period. He was the strangest man I guess I ever met. Shy, very uncomfortable around people he hadn't met before. And he was hard to read. He said some things that were most inappropriate at times. I sat in on many meetings and I thought, my God, I can't believe what the president is saying in light of what he knows and I know. I knew so many things about the White House. I certainly didn't want to testify.
You were employed on January 21st, 19...
Everybody was wondering, who is this person coming in with this briefcase? And he then gave the testimony that literally shocked the world.
Mr. Butterfield, are you aware of the installation of any listening devices in the Oval Office of the President?
Butterfield hesitates, then leans toward the mic.
I was aware of listening devices. Yes, sir.
The room was just drenched in silence, absolute silence. And slowly, as he hesitated, it became clear.
Are you aware of any devices that were installed in the executive office building office of the president?
Yes, sir, at that time.
Were they installed at the same time?
They were installed at the same time.
It wasn't one tape. It was a taping system that recorded 24 hours a day all the conversations in the Oval Office for the past 2 years. And boom, you know, what an explosion.
When Alex Butterfield revealed the taping system, I was stunned. I had no idea it was there. Only a very few select people knew about them, and so I was really taken back.
In an interview with Haldeman.
The tapes were put into the White House at Richard Nixon's orders. He wanted them for the purpose of recording and preserving for his use, his personal use, all of what was said by him and by others in the meetings that he held in the Oval Office and other principal places.
For eventual use, for writing or whatever?
For eventual reference by him.
That's the only reason?
That is the absolutely only reason.
And so that if either Mr. Dean, Mr. Haldeman, Mr. Ehrlichman, Mr. Colson had particular meetings in the Oval Office with the president on any particular dates that had been testified before this committee, there would be a tape recording with the president of that full conversation, would there not?
Yes, sir.
President Nixon, how much money do you need? Dean, I would say these people are going to cost $1 million over the next 2 years. President Nixon, you could get $1 million and you could get it in cash. I know where it could be gotten. At the hearing, officers surround Butterfield.
It dawned on all of us in the press corps that there might be a record of everything that was said that we would know if John Dean had lied or not.
With Ben Veniste.
John Dean was corroborated in chapter and verse without any kind of material deviation by the tapes that Nixon had secretly made and which John Dean did not know existed.
I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it.
I think there's no doubt about the seriousness of the problem we've got. We have a cancer within. Close to the presidency that's growing. It's growing daily.
The tapes verified exactly what he was testifying to.
In Butterfield's interview.
I thought the president might be a little bit intimidated by knowing that these reels are going all the time, but he never did seem to be.
What's the matter with these clowns?
Well, I certainly didn't know when I went to the White House that I was going to have to put up with what I did. It was, in fact, in many ways, a cesspool. You never knew what sort of skullduggery might be the order of the day.
President Nixon, never strike a king unless you kill him. They struck and did not kill. And now we're going to kill them. I don't care what it costs. They're going to be killed.
It was so big, the idea that everything that had been testified to, we'd been listening to, was going to be proved one way or the other. This was the dagger right at Nixon's throat.
The pointed iron fence outside the White House comes into focus. A moving view shifts toward the peak of the Washington Monument. Watergate, High Crimes at the White House.
When you found out all these crimes and conspiracies and cover-ups were being committed, why on earth didn't you walk in the president's office and tell him the truth?
Mitchell testifies.
It wasn't a question of telling the truth. It was a question of not involving him at all.
All around him were people involved in crime, perjury, accessory after the fact, and you deliberately refused to tell him that.
Senator, I think you put it exactly correct.
From CBS News, Washington, live coverage of the Watergate hearings.
I mean, my God, once the hearing started, I could walk from my office to the Capitol and never miss a beat in the television hearings.
Ben Bradley, executive editor, The Washington Post.
Good morning. On this fifth day.
I could hear it. I could hear radio in the cabs. I could see it in offices. It overwhelmed the city because it was so interesting. The abuse of power is a wonderful story.
Just what did the president know, and when did he first know it?
Everybody talked about almost nothing else once those hearings started.
I have to have my Watergate fix every single morning in the paper. I get like this if I haven't got...
There are Watergate junkies.
There was so much humor that came out just from watching the hearings.
They came out with a new doll, Wanda Watergate. And the way Wanda works is whenever she wets, she tries to cover it up.
Johnny Carson smiles.
And everybody in the country had an opinion.
I think Nixon should resign and save his family and the country the embarrassment, that's all.
I believe in my president. I think he's a wonderful man. I think he'll go on to prove what he is.
Nixon faces a crowd.
Say this last sign. I believe in Nixon and America. Let me tell you, I believe in you, every one of you. Thank you.
Nixon was a truly tragic figure. Here was someone who all his life wanted to be the president of the United States.
He didn't want to lose, and winning was at any cost.
And to screw your political enemies.
Yes.
President Nixon, we're up against an enemy, a conspiracy. They're using any means. We are going to use any means. Is that clear?
I don't think there's any question but that Richard Nixon was paranoid about enemies. He saw them everywhere. He lived in a kind of an atmosphere of me versus them. You could see it in his eyes. His eyes are kind of shifting as if they're there. They're somewhere in the walls. They're somewhere in the room.
Never forget the press is the enemy. The establishment is the enemy. The professors are the enemy. Write that on the blackboard 100 times and never forget it.
When people think about Watergate, they also think about how your administration used the Internal Revenue Service to harass people, and how you even had a written down enemies list of opponents to go after and hurt.
Every administration has its friends and its enemies. We always divide press, everybody else, up in those categories. You reward your friends and punish your enemies if you can.
One of John Dean's revelations was that there was an enemies list, that Nixon actually had an enemies list. I think there were 20 names of people that Richard Nixon wanted the IRS to go after. And then one of the names was Daniel Shore, our CBS reporter.
Now, perhaps for the first time, the 20 people designated as White House enemies.
I was on the air live.
With Shore.
I didn't have time to look at this document before I started reading it live. And I began to read down the list until I came to number 17.
17th, Daniel Shore of the Columbia Broadcasting System in Washington. The note here is a real media enemy. Number 18, S. Harris.
Thank you. Hey, you where?
I would imagine every president has an enemies list.
With Chapin.
Nixon's got more attention and publicity.
President Nixon. I want, Bob, more use of wiretapping. A photo shows Nixon with Haldeman.
I mean, these people are in political life. They have people that are trying to end their political life.
President Nixon, maybe we can get a real scandal on any one of the leading Democrats.
leading Democrats.
Nixon and his entourage step off of Air Force One.
Nixon and his team found the soft spot in the American political system. We're gonna pick who Nixon runs against.
Never before, I think, in the history of American politics, has one party actually chosen the candidate of the other party. You try to destroy the front runner, but in this case, they did it with such fraudulent means.
McGovern was the candidate that, beginning in January, when I was tracking all the polls and would study the poll data daily, he was the one candidate that we wanted more than anything else, but never dreamt could ever get nominated.
Who was the guy that you feared?
Muskie. Muskie would have been a much more difficult candidate for Nixon to defeat.
Senator Edmund Muskie.
Let's pick a candidate for president who's got the best chance to beat Nixon. And I think that candidate is me.
They hired a bunch of saboteurs and spies to disrupt the Muskie campaign.
In a 1992 interview with Donald Segretti, political operative.
Got a call out of the blue.
From?
Dwight Chapin, working in the White House. They asked me if I wanted to work in the campaign for Richard Nixon, the 72 election campaign.
And what they really wanted you to do was?
Dirty tricks.
In Chapin's interview.
When I met with Don, the idea that I got across to him was, let's have these Democrats think that one of the other Democratic candidates is the one that caused the problem for them. It was kind of the sowing of seeds of discontent among the rivals that were going after the Democratic nomination.
They even had on their payroll Senator Muskie's chauffeur. Imagine this. And the chauffeur had all the documents that the Muskie campaign had generated. And all of this material went back to the White House.
A headline, the spy at Senator Muskie's headquarters.
One of the really nasty, ugly things they did is they got Muskie's stationery, and then they put out a false press release in which it looked like Muskie was accusing other Democratic candidates, saying they were involved in illegal sexual activity.
It was a letter widely disseminated, accusing senators Hubert Humphrey and Scoop Jackson of sexual and alcoholic misconduct.
It said that he had an illegitimate daughter named Mary Ann Kramer, born February 7th, 1929, etc., etc., etc.
It was totally fallacious. None of it was true.
And you were responsible for this?
I was involved in that, yes.
What it ended up with was pitting the Democratic candidates angrily against one another. They destroyed the one centrist candidate who had the greatest possibility of beating President Nixon in the fall. It, in my judgment, deprived the American people of a legitimate choice.
These reports of wrongdoing by the White House staff are so serious that the president should tell us whether he condones this kind of political espionage operation.
Charles Colson. The biggest negative to the Watergate, in my mind, eventually it's going to come out. There's just too damn many people involved. President Nixon, oh sure, the whole goddamn story is going to come out.
He lost the battle with history because of those tapes. He will never escape them. Those tapes are like an iron right around his neck.
In the briefing room.
So far, the White House has not answered the question whether or not it will make tapes concerning Watergate conversations available to the committee.
July 23, 1973.
The president and the Congress tonight are actually on a collision course. The issue is executive privilege, which Mr. Nixon today invoked when he told both the Irvin Committee and Prosecutor Archibald Cox that he will not give them any White House recordings.
If you notice, the president says he's heard the tapes, or some of them, and they sustain his position. But he says he's not going to let anybody else hear them for fear they might draw a different conclusion. I was in hopes that the president would accede to the request of this committee for these tapes and these papers.
The investigation was getting closer and closer to the White House. Obviously, President Nixon was feeling the heat.
I think it was Senator Baker who said to Senator Ervin, Sam, why don't you call the president? We're all sitting in Senator Ervin's office, and we could only hear one side of the conversation. And then suddenly, Ervin's face got flushed. Well, no, Mr. President. No, we're not out to get you, Mr. President. No, Mr. President, we just want to get at the facts. No, Mr. President, we're not out to get you, Mr. President. No, and his face was getting flusher and flusher. And he finally hung up. And he turned to us and he said, you know what the president was yelling on the phone to me? You have to get me! You have to get me! You have to get me!
Grainy footage shows Nixon hanging up a phone. Nighttime, an aerial view shows Washington, D.C. Watergate, high crimes in the White House.
You don't even sit sometimes and think to yourself, why didn't I burn those tapes?
I must get a half a dozen letters a week even now. Why didn't you burn the tapes? And the answer is, of course, I should. It should have been done. But the main point is, they should never have been started. I never even dreamed that the tapes would ever come out, except historically. If I had, of course, I wouldn't have been discussing Watergate on the tapes.
Hey, sir. What is the situation?
Stephen Bull, special assistant to the president.
I learned about the existence of the taping system when Alex Butterfield left the White House. My title at the White House, I guess officially, was special assistant to the president. Essentially, I ran the president's schedule.
Photos show Bull as a younger man.
I spent a lot of time alone in the Oval Office with the president. I probably saw him 20 times a day.
A guard stands at a parking lot outside the White House. President Nixon. Yeah. Bull. Operator, Mr. Bull. Bull, yes, sir. President Nixon. Hi, Steve. Have you got that thing worked out?
I don't think the president ever listened to a tape until the Senate Watergate Committee had gone into business, and a subpoena was issued for, I don't know, 6 or 7 or 8 conversations. So the president wanted to hear what would be on the tape, and it fell to me to find the tape.
Bull, I'll have it probably in 5 to 10 minutes, and I'll bring it over and set it up. President Nixon, you can set it up over here, can you? Bull, yes, sir. President Nixon, well, you get it right over because I've got to listen to a lot of crap, and I just want to get it over with as fast as I can. A photo shows Nixon in the Oval Office with a tape recorder.
Good evening. The president will address the nation from his Oval Office in the White House West Wing.
If I were to make public these tapes, containing as they do blunt and candid remarks on many different subjects, the confidentiality of the office of the president would always be suspect from now on.
In the archival interview, Nixon gazes downward.
President Nixon's plan to continue preventing investigators from hearing the Watergate tapes has run into trouble. The president ordered Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox to stop trying for access to the tapes and other records.
With Ben Veniste.
The tension created by our demand for the tapes put extraordinary pressure on Archibald Cox.
I'm not looking for a confrontation, and I'm certainly not out to get the President of the United States.
Cox said he will go to court, probably this coming week, where for the first time in the nation's history, a federal prosecutor will attempt to hold the president in contempt of court.
Richard Nixon knew he was in trouble with an independent investigation, and he needed to put an end to it.
October 20, 1973.
This is a special report.
Elliot Richardson, U.S. Attorney General.
This man is no longer Attorney General of the United States.
William Ruckelshaus.
This man is no longer Deputy Attorney General of the United States.
Archibald Cox, Special Prosecutor.
And this man, the Special Prosecutor in the Watergate affair, this man has been fired under orders issued by the President of the United States.
This was a scandal beyond the rule of law. The Saturday Night Massacre.
Please, everyone, no one is allowed in.
The FBI, acting upon orders from the President, sealed off the Special Prosecutor's office.
Our offices have been sealed by the FBI.
How many?
6 FBI agents present.
I must say, I suppose that human emotions take over in this kind of occasion, because one thinks that, you know, in democracy, maybe this would not happen, and that maybe we could proceed in good faith to prosecute those who violated the criminal law. Apparently, that is not to be the case.
The president was able to send FBI agents to the Justice Department. Now we're beginning to think, my God, is he going to call out the army? Is this a military takeover of the government?
This was as close to a coup as we had ever come in our lifetime, and remained so until January 6, 2021.
A sign reads, honk for impeachment.
Since the firing of Watergate prosecutor Cox on Saturday, the pressure on President Nixon has been building. For the first time since Watergate became an issue, there is now some serious talk of impeachment.
Telegrams flooded into Washington. So did calls. Western Union and the Capitol switchboard both hired extra help.
The firestorm created by this made it apparent to members of Congress and to so much of the American people that, yes, everything that we were writing about, that there was a cover-up going on to hide something that was of awful magnitude.
This was big. So why did Nixon do it? He must be hiding something, was the only logical conclusion. And in fact, he was.
3 days after the Saturday night massacre, House Democratic leaders moved to begin an impeachment inquiry. The president released the subpoenaed tapes. A man carries a metal case.
Republican governors reported that President Nixon assured them privately yesterday that he knew of no new Watergate bombs waiting to go off. Well, today, another one did go off in the federal courtroom of Judge John Sirica.
An 18-minute portion of a subpoenaed taped conversation between President Nixon and H.R. Haldeman contains no words, just an audible tone. The gap occurred in the crucial meeting between Haldeman and Mr. Nixon in the White House on June 20th.
We're going to investigate fully and completely, as we've indicated in court.
The White House tried to blame the 18 and a half minutes on Rosemary Woods.
Rosemary Woods, President Nixon's personal secretary, played a portion of one tape to show how she had apparently erased part of one subpoenaed conversation.
This poor woman, she's made to demonstrate physically how she could possibly have erased the tape inadvertently. How she got a phone call, and she turned around and twisted, and the judge just makes it clear he doesn't accept this at all.
Mr. Bull, what was the purpose of preparing these transcripts or summaries by Rosemary Woods?
I do not know, sir.
I firmly believe that neither the president nor Rose Woods had anything to do with making any deliberate erasures on a tape. I'm the only guy who would have known how to do it, and I didn't.
Grainy footage shows Bull heading out of the Oval Office.
After the 18-and-a-half-minute gap had been discovered, I suppose the walls really started closing in. It became a very constricting period of time. And some people were leaving, some people were being indicted, and so it was becoming increasingly grim.
Cronkite reports from his desk.
The Watergate grand jury today indicted seven former top-level Nixon administration and campaign aides for plotting to cover up the scandal. And one of the allegations in the indictment contained the implication that President Nixon himself knew about the cover-up.
The accused included all four of President Nixon's former top advisors. All seven of the men indicted today were charged with conspiracy. Some of the charges also included perjury, lying under oath, and obstruction of justice.
The people closest to Richard Nixon, his confidants, the people he trusted, the only people he trusted, now indicted. It was something. Wow.
Overshadowing what happens to those seven men is the more important question: what does today's development mean for Richard Nixon? For the President of the United States, is the worst now over, or only beginning.
Nixon walks his dog. Nixon gives a speech.
There have been times of discouragement in America, but the American people are not a nation of quitters. We are a nation that will keep fighting on until we succeed.
Rumors, scenarios, and reports about the president possibly stepping aside or stepping down, now or later, are described by his aides as, quote, baloney.
With Senator Barry Goldwater.
At this point, are you satisfied with the way President Nixon is handling the Watergate situation?
I think he's doing it about the only way that he can, with no evidence at all ever been pointed at him of any wrongdoing. Mistakes and judgments, yes, but here's a man that some people have judged guilty without any evidence, which is contrary to the American system.
April 29, 1974.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening. I have asked for this time tonight in order to announce my answer to the House Judiciary Committee's subpoena for additional Watergate tapes. In these folders that you see over here on my left are more than 1,200 pages of transcripts of private conversations I participated in. These transcripts will show that what I have stated from the beginning to be the truth has been the truth.
A black and white photo shows Nixon with the transcripts.
So Richard Nixon releases his version of the tapes, transcripts that were done in the White House.
The transcripts submitted by the White House yesterday are not the entire record, with many places simply described as unintelligible. They are edited. The White House has submitted only material it considers relevant to the Watergate investigation.
The transcripts were a cover-up. You knew it. It backfired on him, releasing his version of the tapes, because by then, he had a credibility problem. And these transcripts were incredible.
July 24, 1974.
In a landmark decision, the Supreme Court ruled 8-0 that President Nixon must turn over 64 subpoenaed White House tapes.
With Henry Ruth.
For the first time, you really had a ruling that a president of the United States is not above the law, that the law will prevail over a president's desire to keep something secret, even though that something is quite relevant to proving a crime.
3 days later.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Mr. Donahue.
Aye.
Mr. Rangel.
Aye.
The House Judiciary Committee voted to recommend that the House impeach President Nixon. It was a solemn moment in the committee as it voted on the first article of impeachment, charging the president with the Watergate cover-up.
27 members have voted aye. 11 members have voted no.
That resolution is adopted and will be reported to the House.
Momentum was building toward a full vote of impeachment in the House and a trial in the Senate. Facing intense pressure, President Nixon released additional transcripts of conversations that occurred just days after the Watergate break-in.
With the new transcripts, the president issued a written statement of his own. In it, he acknowledges that what the transcripts say is, as Mr. Nixon puts it, at variance with what he told the American people on other occasions.
With Ben Veniste.
The so-called smoking gun tape was the denouement that marked the end of the Nixon presidency.
Haldeman, the FBI is not under control. Their investigation is now leading into some productive areas, and it goes some directions we don't want it to go.
That he ordered to have the CIA interfere with the FBI investigation in order to delay and perhaps derail the investigation.
Haldeman, just say, stay the hell out of this. This is business here. We don't want you to go any further on it.
Here was a tape that showed, contrary to everything Nixon had been saying, that he knew about the cover-up from the beginning.
President Nixon, they should call the FBI in and say that we wish for the country. Don't go any further into this case, period.
The suggestion is to have the director of the CIA contact the FBI and say, hey, cease and desist. You're outside your jurisdiction. He should have been arrested on the spot. He obstructed justice.
With Leslie,
there was no way he could move forward once the smoking gun tape came out and it was clear he was involved in the cover-up. No question whatsoever.
A headline, GOP loyalists, it looks like the smoking gun.
His party members were devastated. They were hung out to dry because they had been supporting Nixon and had been telling the American public to believe in Nixon's denials.
With Goldwater.
And I just blew my stack. I said, this is all I'm going to take. I'm going up and talk to the president. I didn't know what the hell I'd talk about, but I was going to go up and talk to him. We sat there in the Oval Room, and the president acted like he just played golf and just had a hole in one. You'd never think this guy's tail was in a crack. Finally, he said to me, Barry, what do you think my chances are in the Senate?
Goldwater says, Mr. President, you have 4 votes, and one of them is not mine.
That's when Nixon knew it was over. When Barry Goldwater said, one of them is not mine, you do not have my vote, Nixon knew it was over.
A U-Haul parks outside the White House with a sign on the side reading, Impeach Nixon.
The man in that high authority, I feel like should know what's going on in his administration. He was informed some way, shape, or form.
He has surrounded himself with individuals who have been found guilty. He's taken the crime out of the streets and taken it right into the White House.
With Dash.
Nixon said, I'm not a crook. If he meant by that, I didn't steal any money. Yes, he didn't steal any money. It would be better if he had. What he did was worse. His breach of trust, his lying to the people, his corruption of our constitutional government was even worse, and it became very dangerous. And I think the public was angry because they saw the potential of such a president really destroying democratic government.
In a photo, Nixon stares out a window. Grainy footage shows the White House. Watergate, high crimes in the White House.
2 minutes to 15 seconds to air, please.
Nixon sits at a desk. August 8, 1974.
Ollie, no, only the CBS crew now is to be in this room during this. Only the crew. No, there will be no picture.
With Bull.
While the camera crew was setting up, I walked with him on his way to give the speech. I knew him to be a fighter and that he would fight up until the very end.
Good evening. In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation.
Uncharacteristically, he asked my opinion, and he said, do you support me? I said, Mr. President, I'll support you in anything you want to do. I just don't particularly like this one. It was a very grim conclusion I had to come to that indeed it was over.
Nixon sits before a microphone.
Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere.
To make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected.
A crowd gathers before a large TV.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office.
Nixon looks downward. At home, Chapin looks through a photo album.
The tears were cascading down my face. It was very traumatic. Very sad, but I believe he acted as a patriot.
With Deborah and Hugh.
He had an amazing legacy, and now his legacy was going to be Watergate. And to me, that was just incredibly sad.
With Leslie.
Having to come before the public and deliver that speech without breaking down. It's so powerful in a human way.
To have served in this office is to have felt a very personal sense of kinship with each and every American.
I can't believe how, over all these years, I could have an emotional reaction that I didn't have at the time.
In leaving it, I do so with this prayer. May God's grace be with you in all the days ahead.
With Bull.
When the president finished his speech, it fell to me to kind of pack up some personal belongings of his. He had on his desk, I guess it was a cigar box or some sort of a silver box. And I picked up the box, not meaning to open it. And it's playing Hail to the Chief.
A close view shows the open box. A black and white photo shows Nixon in profile.
It was one of those moments, if it had been a movie, the concluding title would say, the end.
A photo shows Gerald Ford taking the oath of office.
My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. As we bind up the internal wounds of Watergate, more painful and more poisonous than those of foreign wars, let brotherly love purge our hearts of suspicion and of hate.
1 month later.
I'm Dan Rather. President Ford has granted Richard Nixon a, quote, full, free, and absolute pardon for all offenses the former president committed or may have committed while in office.
My concern is the immediate future of this great country.
You called me up, and let me quote what I'll never forget what you said. You heard. I said, no, I was asleep. The son of a bitch pardoned the son of a bitch.
We had thought at the beginning that it was a terrible act against the national interest.
I felt that he should have probably stood in the well with Mitchell, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Colson because he interfered with the investigation.
Rather reports.
For myself, the system of justice, our sense of justice in this country, equal justice under the law, demands accountability. In this case, there's been no accountability.
We had it wrong.
That's right. He knew that if he did this, in all likelihood, he would lose the presidency in the next election, which of course happened. Unique, probably, in our history, that a president of the United States would make that sacrifice.
My conscience tells me that only I, as president, have the constitutional power to firmly shut and seal this book.
I thought it was one of the most heroic acts in American history. He didn't put his future first. He put the healing of the country first.
This year, especially the past few months and weeks, have been filled with extraordinary days. Today was another one that historians will be writing about and thinking about for years to come.
People walk outside the White House. In Bob and Carl's interview.
It's really interesting to look at the role of Republicans in Watergate and compare the role of Republicans today in the Donald Trump situation, because here you have two presidents unique in our history who sought to undermine the very basis of democracy in the United States.
Photos show rioters attacking the Capitol on January 6th, 2021.
You can't ever accept when they steal and rig and rob. Can't accept.
I see parallels all the time. Nixon was dark and paranoid. It created turmoil in the country. Trump, conspiratorial. There's so many people who absorbed that and made it them.
Leslie interviews Trump.
Do you take any responsibility for the country being divided against itself?
I'd like not to, but when people put out phony witch hunts, you know, when they spy on your campaign, you have to fight back.
All through the Trump presidency, I kept comparing what was going on in the country to what was going on then. The questions about faith in our institution, both times, was always prominent.
June 9, 2022. At the Capitol assault hearings, Ms. Cheney speaks into a mic.
I say this to my Republican colleagues who are defending the indefensible. There will come a day when Donald Trump is gone, but your dishonor will remain.
Footage of the assault hearings gives way to footage of the Watergate hearings. With Deborah and Hugh.
The checks and balances that ultimately worked to expose Watergate and bring justice, if you will, I'm not sure all those mechanisms would work today if push comes to shove, and we're pretty close to that point as far as I'm concerned.
At the very end, the Republican Party went to the president and said, you have no other choice but to resign. You have lost the faith of the people. In those days, you had people who put their country above their party.
With Goldwater.
Mr. Nixon hurt the Republican Party and he hurt America. And frankly, I don't think he should ever be forgiven. He came as close to destroying this country as any one man in that office ever has come.
A black and white photo shows Nixon looking pensive. Grainy footage shows Nixon waving. Watergate, high crimes in the White House. With Bull.
On August 9th, prior to the effective time of his resignation, the president gave an address to the staff in the East Room of the White House.
Nixon stands at a podium and makes a thumbs up gesture.
It was the first time, I think, that the public had really seen Richard Nixon, the man.
Sure, we've done some things wrong in this administration. And the top man always takes the responsibility, and I've never ducked it. No man or no woman ever profited at the public expense. Mistakes, yes. But for personal gain, never.
The way this is shot, you're watching Pat Nixon.
Pat Nixon stands behind her husband.
She looks numb. The woman looks numb.
Always give your best. Never get discouraged. Never be petty.
With Bob.
That is such an amazing moment in presidential history.
It was a kind of self-examination and tour of his psyche.
Always remember, others may hate you. But those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself.
That sense of the destructive power of hate on the self, and Nixon's clear, maybe momentary, maybe eternal realization of that is stunning.
Nixon smiles as he exits the East Wing. A young woman looks tearful, then turns away. Watergate changed the nation and the lives of those who were involved. More than 40 people were convicted of crimes connected to the scandal. At home, Chapin works at a computer.
Let me say this, that the indictments handed down today had nothing to do with my work while I was in the employee of the administration. I have complete faith in the president. I had it when I took my job as a young man when I was 28, and I have it today.
I went to prison for 9 months because somebody thought I made false and misleading statements. And my word is incredibly important to me. I do my very best to be as truthful as I possibly can. And that hopefully will help take care of how history judges me.
Dwight Chapin lives in Connecticut, following a career as a magazine publisher, business consultant, and author. With Judy.
I'm really proud to have been a part of history. I think it's saved our democracy then. At this point, I'm really proud to have been a part of that.
Judy Hoback Miller left the committee to re-elect the president in 1973. She worked for a family investment company for 40 years before retiring to Florida.
Your testimony and your forthrightness have renewed my faith in the old adage that an honest man is the noblest work of God.
Hugh Sloan is retired in Michigan after a long career in the automotive supply industry. Hugh and Deborah Sloan have been married for 51 years.
Are you aware of any devices that were installed in the executive office building office of the president?
Yes, sir.
Alexander Butterfield left the White House in 1973 to lead the Federal Aviation Administration. He went on to a career in the aviation industry. At 96, he is retired in Southern California.
I think I may have done a service to the country. It was a shame that his presidency had to end with a resignation, but it was a good thing. It was the right thing. It was justice served.
White House counsel John Dean served 4 months after pleading guilty to one count of obstructing justice. Today, he works as an author and TV commentator. Attorney General John Mitchell served 19 months in prison for conspiracy, perjury, and obstruction of justice. He died in 1988. Assistant to the President John Ehrlichman was convicted of perjury, conspiracy, and obstruction of justice. He served 18 months in prison. He died in 1999. White House Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman served 18 months in prison for perjury, conspiracy, and obstruction of justice. He died in 1993. In grainy footage, Nixon and Pat walk with Ford and his wife, Betty. As Nixon boards a plane, he turns and waves. He makes the victory symbol. Leslie imitates his gestures.
This image is so powerful, actually. It is a moment of defiance in a way. Ha, I'm not finished yet. But he was.
A photo shows Nixon with his arms outstretched, making the victory symbol.
Richard Nixon had been moved from the lowest point to the highest point, and had achieved so much in his presidency.
Confetti and balloons fall from above onto a crowd of Nixon supporters. With Bull.
And then the balloon popped.
In the 20 years following his resignation, Richard Nixon published his memoirs and worked to rehabilitate his image as an elder statesman and expert on foreign affairs. After suffering a stroke, the nation's 37th president died on April 22, 1994. He was 81 years old.
To those who say, will you apologize? Are you sorry? There's no way that you could apologize that is more eloquent, more decisive, more finite, which would exceed resigning the presidency of the United States. That said it all, and I don't intend to say any more.
A photo shows Nixon from behind as he gazes toward a patio. Audio description created by the Media Access Group at WGBH for Paramount Plus. See It Now Studios.